Welcome to Special Sauce 2.0, SiriusXM's podcast about food and life with an expanded menu. Every week on Special Sauce, we'll get invaluable bites of wisdom from Kenji Lopez-Alt, SiriusXM's chief culinary consultant.
It's a rotating platform with a flamethrower, so it's basically designed just to make pizza. There's not really much else you can do in it.
After Ask Kenji, a conversation with our guest, ice cream genius Nicholas Morgenstern.
I'm inspired and influenced by one of the greatest culinary destinations in America, Dairy Queen. I mean it.
And finally, on today's podcast, Daniel Gritzer, our managing culinary director, dares to say,
"It's okay to sometimes put a tomato in the fridge."
So we're going to start with Ask Kenji. And Kenji, our question of the week. Serious eater Tucker Colvin wants to know, currently, what is your favorite outdoor pizza oven?
Oh, that's a good question. So currently I have three pizza ovens in my backyard. I have a Rockbox, which was one of the recommended ovens in my testing a couple years ago. I have a Uni Pro, which was not released at the time of that testing, but would now be also one of my recommended ovens. And then I also have the Serious Eats edition of the pizza kettle insert, which goes onto a Weber kettle grill. I find them all great for different things. So the reason I have the Rockbox and the Uni Pro is because I do plan on someday maybe doing some kind of comparison of them, although I think now there's a new Uni out anyway, so maybe that's outdated. But both of those ovens work great. The Rockbox is a little smaller, fires up a little faster. I think it looks a little nicer. So it's great if you're only planning on making, you know, things up to maybe an 11-inch pizza and maybe like a skillet with, you know, foods in a skillet that you're going to sear. The Uni Pro is much bigger. You can do probably, I think, like an 18-inch pizza in there. It takes longer to fire up, longer to preheat, but you can do much bigger things in there. You could probably roast a chicken in there even. So if you plan on doing a lot of big cooks, then maybe the Uni Pro, or I think the new one's called the Uni Coda, is where you should go. And then if you want what I think is sort of the best real sort of pizza oven experience where it's really going to get to those really blazing hot temperatures, then the Serious Eats edition of the kettle pizza insert, it's a lot more difficult to work with. It requires a lot of babysitting and management of the fire, but once it gets going, it gets really, really hot. So your pizzas cook as fast as they would in a real wood-fired oven. So those would be my three recommendations. If, you know, they're all on the sort of pricier side, but, you know, with these things you kind of, as I found out in my testing, you kind of get what you pay for. The only sort of cheaper alternative I would recommend is the Black Rock. Is that a pizza oven company or is that an investment bank?
Blackstone.
Blackstone's the name of the oven company. They make an outdoor pizza oven, propane powered. That's around $200 or so, maybe $250. And it's pretty unique. It has a gas jet underneath and above, like a little flamethrower above and below, and then it has a rotating metal plate. And so you put your pizza in one place in the center and it just spins it around and it kind of cooks it one section at a time on its own. It works great. A lot of backyard pizza makers swear by it. I find it to be a little ugly. That's its main problem, is it's really ugly, I think. And it's also sort of limited in what you can do because it's a rotating platform with a flamethrower. So it's basically designed just to make pizza. There's not really much else you can do in it, as opposed to these other ovens where you can also cook other things.
Okay. I thank you, Kenji. And I know that Tucker Colvin thanks you for your pizza oven wisdom.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Kenji Lopez-Alt is SiriusXM's chief culinary consultant and author of The Food Lab. Do send in your questions to Kenji to specialsauce@SiriusXM.com.
I brought some stuff, but I didn't bring spoons.
Oh, don't worry, we got spoons. Nicholas Morgenstern, the founder of what my friend Brian Koppelman calls the Willy Wonka of ice cream shops, Morgenstern's finest ice cream in New York City's Greenwich Village. What flavors did you bring me, Nick?
I know I brought you banana calamansi. I brought you Vietnamese coffee.
Ooh.
This is the banana calamansi.
Wow, you brought me a lot of stuff, man.
Yeah, why not? Once we had the bag out. Strawberry pistachio pesto.
Strawberry pistachio pesto, Vietnamese coffee. What's this one?
We brought you the salted chocolate.
And two, it's raining ice cream in the studio. Two ice cream sandwiches.
Yep.
And then a mint ice cream sandwich and an It's It which is an imitation of the Itzit ice cream bar, I assume, or inspired by the Itzit ice cream bar in San Francisco because you're from Northern California.
Yeah.
Nicholas Morgenstern is such a sweetheart. He brought me a sundae.
Yep.
Intact from his shop in Greenwich Village, a few miles away, and it looks perfect. All right, I got to start with the sundae.
You should. You know, the thing is that I'm inspired and influenced by one of the greatest culinary destinations in America, Dairy Queen. I mean it all the time. I go to Dairy Queen anytime I'm on the road and I can get there. There's one in New York on 14th Street. Have you been there?
Yes, once.
It's total madness in that place. It's like drugs, bad drugs in that place.
This is kind of awesome, man.
Yeah, I'm glad. Well,
I think we have to have Nicholas every week.
Now you should eat that. I'm gonna keep these on dry ice for now.
All right. This is a sundae, yep. And we're gonna get to this. That Nicholas has a sundae bar in his ice cream shop.
Yep.
That's open on Fridays and Saturdays.
Yes.
Complete with old-fashioned stools. It's really cool. Mm-hmm. And this is named the Rosenthal after our friend Phil Rosenthal,
yep.
Creator of Everybody Loves Raymond and his food show, which is called Somebody Please Feed Phil. He challenged you because I remember I was
there. You were there. That's why I brought it.
You know, and so what is this? What am I eating? I mean, I know I'm eating chocolate. I know I'm eating peanut butter.
It's the best chocolate peanut butter thing ever anywhere, according to Phil. He made that statement before we had made the sundae, so then we had to live up to it. So peanut butter ice cream, chocolate ice cream.
I taste them all.
That's the peanut butter in the sauce.
Yeah, got it.
So
okay.
There's peanut butter sauce, there's chocolate sauce, there's peanut butter crunch, there's chocolate crunch, there's peanut butter cookies, there's chocolate, kind of pieces of chocolate in there.
Yeah, I kind of all agree. The things. And by the time this interview is over, I know I'm going to inspire you to do a Serious Eats Sundae.
Sundae. Or maybe a Serious Eats something.
Mm-hmm.
Sundaes are one medium. There's a
Got
lot
it.
Of mediums.
So. All right.
Yeah.
So tell us about life at the Morgenstern family table growing up.
Oh, that's interesting. My parents don't know anything about food.
Okay.
And they don't have taste buds, really, either of them, that respond to anything. So my earliest connections with food, and most importantly ice cream, really came through my grandfather, my dad's dad, Grandpa Morgenstern, who had a pretty pedestrian palate as far as food was concerned. This is in Southern Ohio, and mostly like meat and potatoes kind of cooking, and always cooking at home, but kind of like post-war industrial, a lot of things
right.
coming out of a can. But he had been in the war, and he had worked in a dairy to put himself through college on the GI Bill. And in that dairy, they made ice cream. So when he was young, he would have been having that experience. And I think he really established a clear connection with sort of like coming home and whatever prosperity he had through eating ice cream. So by the time I came along when he was in his 50s, and my brother and I spent time with him in our summers going to Southern Ohio for about a month or 6 weeks every summer, there was always ice cream at every single meal. And not as like a gluttonous indulgence, it was just a part of...
Yeah, just part of the ritual.
It was part of eating supper. And
yeah.
So butter pecan was Grandpa Morgenstern's favorite flavor, so there would always be that in the freezer. And then...
And what brand?
It would have been like Breyers or just like a supermarket. This would have been in
right.
the early 80s, so nothing extraordinary or special. I gathered a connection to Ben & Jerry's later, like a little bit later in the mid or late 80s with Chunky Monkey and Cherry Garcia and New York
Got
Bar
it.
Crunch, really when that product was fantastic. I think I forged my own path with connecting with food in high school earlier. I ate a lot of Itzits when I was in high school.
Itzits are awesome. We should explain what an Itzit bar is.
Right. So Itzit is an ice cream sandwich that was created in San Francisco. I think they were created in either 1919 or 1920. Family-run business, still family-run. They have a factory in South San Francisco in Burlingame. They used to have the factory out by Ocean Beach, like in the Sunset District, like way back in the day. They make five ice cream sandwiches, vanilla chocolate, strawberry, coffee, mint, and then seasonally they make pumpkin, which is really funny, I think.
And it's on, is it on, it's on oatmeal cookies.
I'm getting there. I didn't
All right, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. I didn't mean to step on you.
Well, you have to understand that the ice cream sandwich, the It's It ice cream sandwich for me is the platonic ideal of an ice cream sandwich.
It.
I love novelties. I love ice cream novelties, but I think I have a really strong connection to that. And I think I objectively love the It's It ice cream sandwich because it is on these oatmeal cookies that you can't really tell that they're oatmeal cookies. They're sort of meant to be benign or generic. But upon like further review, I think you realize that the oatmeal cookie is like the right texture and vehicle. There's no raisins in this cookie.
No.
And the oats have been kind of processed and chopped. So, and then the whole thing is dipped in chocolate.
Yeah.
So they have it really perfected, and it's very reasonably priced. I haven't purchased one in the Bay Area. They're mostly in California. You know,
yeah,
they're all around
for sure.
California. But they're less than $3.
Yeah. There's
still.
You know that I was hired by Northwest Airlines to find local foods to serve on flights out of certain American cities, and I sourced It's It ice cream bars to serve in coach on Northwest Airlines for
Amazing.
A couple of years.
Amazing. They should still be serving those.
I know. Well, you know, the history of airline catering is not a pretty one.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's gotten mildly better, maybe.
Sort of. It kind of
not
ebbs
really.
And flows,
yeah.
Right? You know, sometimes.
True, true. Someone famous just was hired to go to do something recently.
That periodically happens, you know.
Yep.
I put together a consulting chef's team with a lot of great cooks, Tom Douglas, Nancy Oakes, Nancy Silverton, and, you know, you can only get so far. But that's a whole other podcast,
sure.
Nicholas. So your family growing up was not the easiest family to grow up in. I'm familiar with this. I had my own set of setbacks with my family growing up. But how did that affect you? And you know, your mom was joined a cult, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I was pretty young, when I was 14. Yeah, so I had grown up living with her, and then she left and took my brother with her when I was 14. He was 12. And then I was living with my father, who I hadn't lived with prior to that. So that was like kind of like a roommate type of a scenario.
And he had his own issues.
We all do. So I think it was a situation where I just kind of got through that time, you know, in my life, and then had to get out and figure out what I was going to do with myself.
Well, you could either put one foot in front of the other, or you can crawl up in a ball and go into the closet.
Right. Sometimes there's probably a little bit of both of those things happening.
Right, for sure. But you obviously decided you were going to move forward with an intense focus.
Yeah, not necessarily a specific goal. I think that that's a misconception. But yeah, like progressing with energy and work and the process of living and creating things is been something that I think has propelled me for a lot of my life.
Yeah.
So, and you never, at least for me, I never felt like I knew exactly where that was going to land me. And I started cooking in the mid-90s. I graduated from high school in 96, and I went to culinary school the following year.
You had to work your way, right?
Yeah. Well, I got a loan for some of my culinary education, and then I paid for the other part of it that I couldn't get a loan for with. I was working. Yeah, I mean, I always was working.
You were a mechanic.
Right. I worked as an auto mechanic. Yeah. I like to work on cars. Just being from California, that's a different part of the culture. I've been in New York for so long, and at least in New York City, that's not a part of the culture.
But you like to work. Every time I've ever been at your shop, you're working on the store.
Yeah, I care about that way.
You're very handy. Right, you need to come to my house because I'm so unhandy.
Yeah, you could help you fix some things.
I could help you.
I don't
help
like
me
to fix
things.
I don't fix that much stuff at my house, though.
I
my apartment, I should say. Like, Once in a while, there's like a spurt of having to like rectify some things to have it be functional. But yes, in the store, I'm always kind of like working on things. But the store is, how do I explain that? It's this thing that's always in motion and moving. It's kind of like a vehicle. And so you have to be monitoring and maintaining the vehicle and cleaning it and fixing it so that it can continue to move forward. So that's why I do that.
So you're essentially an ice cream store mechanic, Dan.
Yeah, I am. And we're like having to fix things in the store all the time. And I'm dealing with fixing things right now. I was, dealing with that today, actually, just like making sure that the equipment is functioning properly. Ice cream store is going to have a lot of like somewhat sensitive equipment because of all the freezers and all that kind of
stuff.
Got it. So, I spend some time doing that stuff.
So you go to culinary school. You decide you're going to go into pastry.
Mm-hmm.
And you end up at a few serious restaurants in San Francisco.
I'd say one really serious restaurant in
San
Francisco.
Which was Michael Mina.
Michael Mina's Aqua.
Uh-huh.
And he wasn't as big then as he is now as far as operating a lot of things. So he had a couple restaurants when I was working for him. Charles Knob Hill, which was being run by Ron Siegel, who very famously was the first American chef to win the Japanese Iron Chef.
Yeah, and a really good cook that not very many people remember or know about.
Yeah, and he was like the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had Aqua, and then they had, while I was there, they were opening a restaurant called Pisces, which no longer exists, which was in San Mateo. And it was built into a little train station. It was a cool little restaurant.
Did you immediately hear the siren call of ice cream?
Well, the environments that I worked in, all of those places were at a high enough level even back then that they all had an ice cream machine.
Mm-hmm.
So you were always making your own ice cream.
I
worked at very few restaurants where you were like buying the ice cream from outside. You were always making the ice cream. So I was making ice cream there then, working for him. Aqua was a pretty serious experience. I had worked in Europe before that. I went to Germany right out of culinary school, and I worked there for a year. I
worked
for the U.S. military.
That's right. You worked in the military. That's right. You worked in the military.
But I had some experiences there visiting and sort of staging in German ice cafes,
mm-hmm.
which are these little cafes that sell some pastry, coffee, but then they like really are focused on the ice cream.
Interesting.
And, in this country, we could like be so lucky to have those types of businesses kind of sprinkled around where there's like one person who's like really maniacally focused on making just beautiful small batch ice cream in the way that they did there, and a fairly German approach to the way that they maintain their organization and their shop and then the way that they handle their product, which is like a little bit sterile, but like very well executed and very good product made with great ingredients.
So what is ice cream's fundamental appeal to you?
I mean, the product itself is a terrific vehicle for expression for me, and it still is I think it's a medium that still offers me a lot of opportunity to explore expressing that. Mm-hmm. It's become more and more interesting to me to think about it as a cultural reference point, especially in America, and what it means to Americans and why it's so important. So I'm 41. I've been running Morgan Stern's for 5 years as its own entity on Rivington Street. Just about a year ago, we opened a big store where you've been on Houston and LaGuardia.
I've been in both.
Right, but you and I met there.
Right.
I've sacrificed most stuff in my life to do this, consciously and unconsciously. And it continues to open my eyes to all different kinds of challenges and opportunities. And so making and selling ice cream represents 20 or 25% of what it takes to do what we're doing with Morgan Stern's. There's a couple distinctions to make. I own Morgan Stern's by myself. And I also am responsible for everything that we do. So I deal with all the operations and the human resources and all of just everything that we do, all the finances, all the economics. So as far as like what goes on within the organization, I run the store with a pastry chef and a pastry sous chef. We have an office manager, and then we have obviously a lot of employees who all have their own job descriptions. But we don't have director of operations and things like those kinds of parts of the business, at least not at this stage.
That sounds to me like you're kind of a hands-on control freak.
Well, yeah, I want things to go a certain way.
I think that's a nice way of saying control freak.
Well, that's just, I've sacrificed a lot to have this thing that is really...
Yeah.
But I work a lot. I spend a lot of hours there in the place and doing things that, you know, some of my contemporaries, whether they're in food or not in food, think that I shouldn't be doing, or it's like not smart for me to be doing all of those things. At this point, it's all moves the brand in the direction that I want to move it in. So whether that's like fixing the equipment and like dealing with all, I'm just like really involved in all the things that we do. And I work with people that I really like to work with. So that's what it is. So it's getting a little bit cultish in there sometimes. I think people have made that observation where you were like all kind of on this mission, but it's very challenging. Morgenstern's is a really busy place. There's like a lot of people, you know, and we just finished our first summer in the big store, but you know, we average 3,000 people a day. You know, it's like
that's a lot of ice cream, man.
Yeah, and we make it all ourselves, and we make every single thing. You know, we buy the junior mints and we buy the Oreos, but we make everything.
How many flavors in all?
Right. So the big store has 88 flavors.
That's all?
Right. We could do more.
But it's 88 flavors, and we should explain, because I know a little bit about ice cream making, mm-hmm, which mm-hmm. is a dangerous thing, knowing a little.
Mm-hmm.
Each one has its own base, right?
Each one has its own recipe and its own base.
Yeah, so, you know, in many ice cream shops, they use one base and then just flavor the base.
Correct.
You don't do that. Because that would be easy.
Yeah, it's also not as good.
No, it's definitely not as good. So ice cream is like your métier, you know, it's like, but you stretch your own canvases and you develop your own palate.
Yep.
And it's much more than just a summer treat.
You're right. We are interested in making everything that we make. And yes, every single flavor, we write the recipe for every flavor. And you know, like I said, there's a lot of challenges. So for us now, like adding a lot more volume to what we do and how we handle the product that then forces us to evolve the way that we make it and the way that we rotate our product, just like all these different things that we have to like focus on. So it's endlessly challenging. It's what it feels like now. There are times and days where it feels more difficult.
A little overwhelming, I assume.
Yeah, it's a little overwhelming. I've created this whole thing, like this
it's
whole
mess.
It's
all your fault.
Yeah, that's right. So
you have nobody to blame,
that's
dude.
Correct, yeah. So people say, they're like, you did this. You know, I didn't have to. I decided to put 88 flavors on the menu and thought that was a good idea. So that's what I do. And that is its own challenge.
Yeah.
And then maybe now I'm just getting to the point in my life where I can, you know, have some perspective on like how and why I make the decisions that I make and what those things mean and the impact that it has on my life, the relationships that are in my life. But it's a difficult reality sometimes to exist in where you're like, you know, dividing the attention between perspective and observation about what you're doing and then just like having to do the things that you got to do every day. And I work a lot of hours. Believe me, I'm tired. It's tiring. I'm aware of it being tiring. I'm aware of being exhausted or tired affects your ability to have perspective, affects the ability to make decisions. So I have to monitor that carefully for myself to continue to achieve the things that I want to achieve. So I'm driven by the idea that we will continue to get to the point that Morgenstern's will be the best that it can be, and that then I can't be the best that I can be if I'm like a mess.
I get the feeling that if I were to ask you who you were most profoundly influenced by, it probably wouldn't be an ice cream maker.
recently I was reconnected with the pastry chef that I worked for at Danielle, at Danielle's flagship restaurant here in New York. His name is Eric Bertoia. And when I went to work for Danielle in 2000, I started there in 2001, kind of like as a stage, but I really started working there, I think it was 2002. And he came back to see me recently. I've seen him at events, but he came back and we spent time and we talked for a couple of hours, like about a month ago. And it really reminded me how much he has influenced the way that I think about flavor and things like that. Mm-hmm. And also, like, how familiar it was to be around him and just, like, communicate with him and talk to him. He has this consistently upbeat energy that's also succinct.
Mm-hmm.
He, like, punches through positivity. It's hard to explain, but he has this way of communicating that's, like, punctuated positivity. And he has no... you know, dog in the race with in the fight with me. He just kind of came to talk to me and spend time with me, and we talked for a while.
So, what makes a Morgenstern's flavor a Morgenstern flavor? What makes your ice cream your ice cream?
We don't use eggs in our ice cream.
Okay.
It's low sugar content.
Okay.
Relatively low sugar content, relatively low butter fat, and there's no preservatives.
And flavor wise, like,
on the spectrum of the menu.
Yeah.
So all of the flavors are written with the concept of it being a part of a matrix. They all fit together.
That is a complicated matrix, dude.
It is, and it really gets into the psyche of the American consciousness around ice cream.
88 flavors.
They all are there like a puzzle. So it's this, it's true.
It's amazing.
So part of the reason Morgenstern's is successful is because no one else is willing to do what I'm doing.
Because you're insane, dude.
It's true.
In the best possible way.
I don't mean recently I just said, I don't have any insecurity about what I'm doing. People say things, they're just like, what? And I'm like, I cut my hair every day and I go in and I do this thing. I don't know. This is what I'm doing. I'm fully, this is my choice. I've decided to do this. I ride my bicycle to and from my shop 6 days a week. And I could be doing a lot of other things. I really don't care. I'm doing this and this is what I'm doing.
All right. Listen, first of all, I have to finish this this Rosenthal.
Take your time.
Because it's awesome. But there's so many other things that we have to get into. But we have to leave this episode here. And thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, Nicholas Morgenstern. And you and I will have a lot more to say to each other in the next episode.
I'm looking forward to it.
But now it's time to answer the question, is it ever appropriate to put tomatoes in the fridge? Our own managing culinary director, Daniel Gritzer, just tackled this one in a video on Serious Eats. Because this is audio, we can't show the staff throwing tomatoes at him for saying sometimes yes. But here's Daniel with the cold hard facts.
Look, I was once like one of the many people out there who believed firmly that you should never put a tomato in the refrigerator. But I've changed my mind and I want to tell you why. I want to be clear up front. I do not think the refrigerator is the best place to store a tomato. There's plenty of anecdotal experience and scientific studies that have established that fact. The problem is that by establishing that the refrigerator is not the best place to store a tomato, a rule has emerged that people follow blindly and dogmatically without ever thinking about whether there might be situations in which refrigerator is the better place to store a tomato. Sometimes it's your best option. There are even studies that back this up. I saw one study that found that you can put a tomato in the fridge for up to 3 days with no noticeable loss in flavor. Only when you get to 7 days and more does the flavor really start to fall off. And a tomato is like an avocado, a banana, a peach, a melon. It is a fruit that continues to ripen even after it's been picked. What this means is a tomato has this really nice, slow, gradual ramp up towards ripeness. It hits its peak, its moment of perfection, and then it drops off precipitously after that. The flavor starts to taste duller, it loses some of its clear acidity that balances out its natural sweetness. The texture goes from silky to mushy. And eventually the tomato starts to rot. It starts to develop really soft, squishy spots. Mold grows on it. It caves in on itself. It's disgusting. And it can happen really quickly, especially at warmer temperatures. My advice is leave your tomatoes out at room temperature until they reach their moment of ripeness or they're getting really close to it. And then if you're not gonna eat them right away, like within 12 or 24 hours, refrigerate them. I promise you, in most cases, that tomato will be better than one that you let sit out past its peak at room temperature longer than you should have. When you are ready to eat them, try to let them come back to room temperature before you do. So a couple days ago, I went to the farmer's market here in New York City, and I bought a variety of different tomatoes. I got a few different kinds of heirlooms, some grape and cherry tomatoes, I got some beefsteaks. And over the course of the past few days, I have looked at the tomatoes and decided which ones felt like they were reaching their peak and moved them to the fridge. If the no refrigeration rule is true, then what testing should show is that in almost every instance, a refrigerated tomato should clearly be ranked worse in a blind tasting than its room temperature stored counterpart. But it's just not what we found. The results were very messy. It was not clear cut one way or the other, but that's the point. Messy results undermine the never refrigerate rule. So here we have three of these Sun Gold cherry tomatoes. I'll cut into them first and just kind of take a look. And I think we all kind of know, like, of all the tomatoes, cherry tomatoes tend to fare the best in the refrigerator. Room temp, hasn't seen a fridge. It's very good. The one that's been in the fridge for just a day. Very sweet. 2 days of refrigeration, and it's really nice and sweet and delicious. None of them have been ruined. The cherries, the grapes, the beefsteaks, and now these, none of them, would I say, so far, have been ruined texturally. Either from being out too long or from being in the fridge. This one was left out at room temperature. And this one has got mold festering on the bottom of it. Now the whole tomato is not bad. You can still eat it. You can cut out the bad spot. By no means is this tomato ruined, but these tomatoes were all really like pushing the edge of ripeness, and leaving this one out has not done it any favors. This is when you want to put a tomato in the fridge to avoid this kind of thing. This refrigerated one, in my opinion, is better than this never refrigerated one. And that's the thing the fridge can help you with. It's when your tomato is cresting its peak and on its way down, it can slow down that descent, it can kind of hold you at the peak longer. And even when you've gone over the top, it can help you retain some of the qualities that make the fruit nice to eat. That's the point in all this tasting. It's not the refrigerator's good, it's not that the refrigerator's the best place to put your tomatoes, it's definitely not. It's just that it's more complicated than saying never put a tomato in the fridge. That's the point. Look at your tomatoes, exercise some judgment, and maybe sometimes consider that the fridge might be your best option.
Tomato Truths from Serious Eats Managing Culinary Director Daniel Gritzer. And that's special sauce for this week. Next time, Kenji tells one serious eater the best way to make naan in a tandoor ovenless home. And do send in those questions to specialsauce@serioseats.com. And Nick Morgenstern returns topping today's conversation about his amazing ice cream. Plus, Rick Bayless teaches me to make a fresh ginger sparkling margarita. So long, Serious Eaters. See you next time.